This is Revolution Under Siege, Episode 12, Warlords of Ukraine. This will be a two-part explainer. Listen on to find out about the events of the Russian Civil War in Ukraine in the year 1919.
This is a significant and very quick advance from the Ukrainian army that, of course, as you alluded to, has been making now gains for about 4 days in the east of Ukraine, particularly in the region of Kharkiv.
We live in an incredible situation. The city is practically destroyed. They destroyed everything that could be destroyed. The Ukrainian armed forces did everything possible for this, and especially Azov made its best effort.
Evidence of war crimes that was discovered when the Russians retreated north of Kyiv in places like Bucha and Irpin. And the Russians still hold large part of the country, whether it's in the Donbas region or in the south in the Kherson region.
The current war in Ukraine lends immediacy to the topic that we're going to discuss in this podcast. This is Revolution Under Siege, a series about the Russian Civil War. If you want to follow up my citations or look at the latest edits, you can find us on 1919review.wordpress.com. And there I have lots of other writings on history and culture. To begin with, we will contrast Ukraine in 1919 with Ukraine in 2022. Then we'll begin a roundup of some of the array of factions which contended for power in Ukraine during the Civil War. So in 1917, obviously, Ukraine was in step with the broader Russian Revolution. From April to November 1918, the Ukrainian Revolution was left to simmer under the heavy-lidded Austro-German military occupation. With the end of the Great War, the German and Austrian empires collapsed. And meanwhile, the end of the Turkish Empire opened up Ukraine's Black Sea coast. So there's a power vacuum created. And within a few weeks, an array of diverse factions had appeared all over the country. For a long time, no force was capable of holding the capital city, Kyiv, for longer than a few months. Nobody could count on their allies, and nobody was in full control of their own soldiers. Suffice it to say that between 1917 and 1920, Kyiv changed hands 16 times. All this, obviously, entailed massive suffering for the unfortunate people of that country. Then, like now, people were dying in terrible numbers in combat. Masses of unarmed people were forced to leave their homes. Civilians were murdered. In this series, and in the daily news, you'll see the same place names, or the same cities under new names. If we look at 1919 through a prism of 2022, we will miss some essential points. 1. This was a civil war between Ukrainians, with direct armed intervention from a range of other countries, including Poland, France, Romania, and of course Russia, both white and red. It was not an invasion of Ukraine by the Russian state, like what we see today. But even to speak of Russian intervention in 1919 in the same breath as French intervention is not really fair, and you'll see why that is below. 2. In 1919, the war was fought primarily on socio-economic questions. Workers against bosses, peasants against landlords, peasants against the varicolored armies which lived by pillaging them. In 2022, this is not the case. Ukraine in 1919, as in 2022, is not a small nation. Its language, culture, and people suffered vicious oppression under Tsarism. But one-fifth of the empire's population resided in Ukraine. 20 million people, or even 32 million, depending on how you count them. 3. Ukrainian nationalism in 1919 was simply not the force it is today. In February 2022, when Putin's regime invaded Ukraine, he probably counted on splits developing within the Ukrainian government, military, and society. From that day to this very morning, the Ukrainian people have not fragmented under the onslaught, but on the contrary, have cohered. They got behind the Zelensky government, even though most of them didn't trust Zelensky before the war. In 1919, the situation was very different. And this quote contains the word inculcate, which I've never actually heard spoken but only ever seen written. So I'm probably going to mispronounce it, along with 5 or 10 Slavic names. Apologies for that. Enervating to Ukrainian efforts towards statehood was the very weakly developed sense of nationalism in the territories it claimed as quote-unquote Ukrainian. Despite the inculcation of Ukrainian nationalism by successive generations of intellectuals during the 19th century, few of the region's numerically predominant peasant population seem yet to have absorbed the notion of a distinct Ukrainian identity by the early 20th century. End quote. This is a very polite way of saying that Ukrainian nationalism did not have large support. Ukraine in 1919 was a land of farmers, and Ukrainian was a language spoken in villages. The cities were dominated by Russians and Poles in the civil service and the professions, and by Jewish people in commerce and intellectual life. The urban population was minuscule. In 21st century Ukraine, 70% of the population lived in cities before the war, and most of those city folk speak Ukrainian. It's a nation of workers and not of peasants. It's ruled not as in the early 20th century by Polish and Russian landlords, they're long gone, but by Ukrainian capitalist oligarchs. The classes in Ukraine, the way people live and make a living, the national consciousness, have all changed utterly. Just to give a vivid example of how much has changed in the last 100 years, if today Kyiv was only 18% Ukrainian, and many of those 18% spoke Russian and considered themselves Russian, then Putin's attack on that city would have turned out very differently. But those were the numbers in 1919. In the July 1917 local elections, only 12.6% of the vote in small towns went to overtly Ukrainian parties, and the corresponding figure for larger towns was 9.5%. And we have seen, through the events in Russia, how decisive the city population, and in particular the working class, was in this period in shaping the political outcomes. Unlike today, the idea that Ukraine should be an independent state did not actually have the support of a critical mass of the people. And throughout 1917, the Ukrainian nationalists were calling for autonomy, not independence. Among the urban and working class population, the idea had very little support at all. 4. In 1919, the Ukrainian nationalists did not have the support of the Allies. Today, Western leaders are effusive in their support, but in 1919, the Allies were suspicious of the idea of Ukraine being autonomous or independent. Remember, they hoped to see the white generals win the civil war, and these whites spoke of Ukraine as Little Russia, and one of their key slogans was Russia One and Indivisible. Why antagonize the white generals by quote-unquote dismembering Russia? What was more, in February 1918, the Ukrainian nationalists signed a peace treaty with Germany. For this, the Allies never forgave these Ukrainian nationalists. To sum up, there are some major differences between Ukraine 100 years ago and Ukraine now. Ukraine in 1919 was as crucial a theater of war as the Don country or Siberia. But civil war in Ukraine was even more complex than in Russia. Below are roundup of the various factions that contended for power in Ukraine in 1919 will further illustrate these points. The Hetmanate. As we have seen, in February and March 1918, the Germans advanced across Ukraine from the west, driving the Red Guards before them. The Ukrainian nationalists, led by Petlura and Vinnychenko, took Kyiv as the Reds cleared out, but soon surrendered to the advancing German military, The Germans tolerated Petlura and Vinnichenko for about 5 minutes before ousting them in a coup and setting up a puppet government. The leader of this government was Pavlo Skoropadsky, a Russianized Ukrainian general and a former aide-de-camp to the Tsar, no less. His title was Hetman, which is a Ukrainian term for warlord. So this government was known as the Hetmanate, which I'm probably saying wrong. In superficial trappings, the government of Hetman Skoropadsky protested its Ukrainianness as if to compensate for its subservience to Germany. The Hetman spoke only a little bit of Ukrainian, and his ministers were from Russian political traditions, hostile to Ukrainian liberation. The Constitutional Democrats, or Cadets, and the Octoberists. They abolished all the reforms that had been brought in before the coup by Petlura, Vinnichenko and co., and they banned strikes. The Hetmanate, quote, jarringly bedecked itself with the pseudo-Cossack trappings of a semi-mythologized Ukrainian national reawakening. Uniforms, flags, titles and ranks, not heard of since the 17th century, and some not even then, could be espied on the boulevards. End quote. The rifleman of the 1st Blue Coat Division of the Sechevye Streltsy wore a tall furry hat with a blue flam, a long blue coat called a juppan, and baggy trousers of 17th century fashion known as shadovari. But the reality of national oppression is summed up in one statistic, and it speaks louder than blue shadovari. 51,428. The number of railway carriage loads of grain and other goods, which were, under the aid of the Hetman, stolen from the Ukrainian people and taken to Germany and Austria. When the German Empire collapsed in revolution, the pantomime was up, and Hetman Skoropadsky knew it. He cleared out on the next train to Berlin, dressed as a German officer. He made it to safety, so evidently this disguise was more convincing than his attempt to pass as a Ukrainian nationalist. Most of my sources skim over the fact that there was a serious, if brief, war between the Hetman and the forces which overthrew him, the Rada. In this war, the Allies promised to support the Hetman and even landed 5,000 British troops at Mykolaiv, but they were neutralized by the warlord Grigoriev, who we will look at later. The Rada. We already saw how in 1917 a parliament took power in Kiev, calling itself the Rada. It was dominated by liberal and social democratic Ukrainian nationalists. Though at first it appeared that the Rada and the Soviets might tolerate one another, even after the Rada suppressed the Kiev Soviet, they ended up at war. The Kiev arsenal workers were massacred by the Rada forces, and then the left SR Muraviev, who would later mutiny on the Volga, led a horde of Red Guards into Kiev, a horde is really all you can call it, with much bloodshed and shellfire. Then, as we have seen, came the Germans, who first allowed the Rada to stay in power, then had them overthrown in a coup. Revolt simmered, partisan forces organized. The Rada led a 30,000 strong rebellion against the Hetman during the summer. After the Hetman jumped on the train to Berlin, a largely peasant army swept Petlura to power. The Rada forces seized Kiev. This regime was known as the Ukrainian National Republic, or the Directorate, but for the sake of clarity and continuity, I'll continue to call it the Rada. The leading figures were the aforementioned Vinnichenko and Petlura, two former members of the Social Democratic and Labour Party, that is, the same party that the Bolsheviks came out of. They passed laws nationalizing industry and seizing the great private estates of the landlords. But the regime did not have the time or the machinery to implement these reforms. In fact, it was a regime dominated by military types. In one source I read that they nationalized industry, etc. But in another source I read that it was a regime of the military and the bourgeois and professional classes, which did nothing to win over the workers and did not espouse, quote, social reform on any significant scale, thus failing to rally the peasants, end quote. That's from E.H. Carr. These failures were frankly and repeatedly admitted by Vinnichenko, who also admitted that, quote, so long as we fought the Russian Bolsheviks, the Muscovites, we were victorious everywhere. but as soon as we came into contact with our own Bolsheviks, we lost all our strength. Cultural Ukrainianization, meanwhile, aroused hostility among the population. Vinichenko also later confessed that the Rada's political appeal forced the Ukrainian people to choose between nation and class, and the Ukrainians chose class. The Rada only remained in power a short time. Just like in 1918, the Rada barely got time to unpack its bags in Kiev before it was chased out, this time by the Red Army. Petlura fled west to Vinnytsia, where he formed a more right-wing regime, purged of Social Democrats and SRs. Three, the Poles. Ukrainians often have cause to explain to foreigners that there are two, three or more ways of pronouncing their name, or the name of their hometown. To explain it in Irish terms, it's like the Derry / Londonderry debate, or when a Sean is pointedly addressed as John, or when a member of the Ward family signs off as MacInvard. The different versions of names are statements, rooted in a history of conflict. Take one city which is today in western Ukraine, the city of Lviv. In 1919, there were at least five different ways of spelling and pronouncing that name. It was the chief city in what the Poles called East Galicia and the Ukrainians called West Ukraine. It had been for centuries a part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. This empire had all Ukrainian units in its army during World War I. In November 1918, at the war's end, these Ukrainian soldiers rose up in revolt. They seized Lviv and declared a West Ukrainian People's Republic, WUPR, allied to the Rada, but the Polish state newly arisen to the west had designs on the same territory. The WUPR fought a bitter and bloody war for its survival against the new Polish army. The region was stricken by famine in these years, as a result of the heavy fighting. After the Rada was chased out of Kiev by the Reds in February 1918, they found refuge with the WUPR. But this refuge was worn down by constant attacks from all sides, by which I mean all directions and also all contending factions. In April, Petlura signed away West Ukraine / East Galicia to Poland in a peace treaty. For this, the WUPR elements never forgave him, and in emigre circles after the war they denounced the Rada as, quote, rude East Ukrainian peasant cousins. 4. The Whites.
It's very interesting that last summer, at a time when Russian tanks and armoured vehicles were already assembling on Ukraine's borders for what we now know as basically a dress rehearsal for the invasion, Putin did an extraordinary thing. He became an amateur historian.
From the point of view of the historic destiny of Russia and its people, Lenin's principles of building the state weren't a mere mistake. That was much worse than a mere mistake. After the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, this has become absolutely obvious.
Ukraine bled seamlessly into the southern front of the Russian Civil War. Rostov-on-Don today is only a three-hour drive from Mariupol. The Volunteer Army was going from strength to strength in early 1919, and several thousand of these former officers and cadets occupied the Donbass region. The industrial working-class Donbass region was certainly not their natural habitat. Their numbers were not impressive, and their commander, General Maimevsky, was a heavy drinker who looked, quote, like a dissolute circus manager, end quote, and brought with him a travelling brothel. Yet in the first half of 1919, this small army held the Donbass against three successive Red offensives, greater numbers. How did they do this? Professional soldiers are more mobile than mere militia, and they're steadier than partisans. They can wring the maximum out of whatever advantages they possess. In this case, British aircraft scouted for the volunteers, who made good use of the dense railway network of the Donbass. Under the leadership of Maimevsky, who was courageous and brilliant in spite of first impressions, they were able to concentrate their forces at the decisive places whenever the Reds advanced. The occupation of the Donbass and the support of the British Navy meant that the Whites were a factor in southern Ukraine. Here we can compare 1919 and 2022. The white program for Ukraine was broadly similar to Putin's today. They did not want to loosen their grip on what they called Little Russia. As for Lenin and the Bolsheviks, Putin today condemns them for their acknowledgement of Ukraine's right to its own culture and to self-determination. For him, the prophecies of medieval saints carry more weight than the aspirations of 40 million people who just want to live in peace. This is the regime in Russia which has erected monuments to white generals, which has rehabilitated their name and buried them with full military honours. And it's no coincidence. It's the same great Russian chauvinism, as it was termed at the time. So, a quick recap. We have the Ukrainian Rada struggling to survive on the western edge of the country, and we have the White Guards growing in strength on the eastern edge, in the Donbass. The German military and their puppet Hetman are already out of the game, and in the east, the new Polish state is muscling in. In the next part, we're going to look at Ataman Grigoriev, and we're going to take a sharp turn left to see the Reds and the Anarchists in action. Thanks for listening. Slán liv an ach mhaibre abu.